There are three groups of Persian poets. The first, those who are absolutely meaning-oriented.
Iqbal, as a poet, is highly accomplished. He has bridged the gap between wisdom and heart.
The second, those who are pedantic. Meaning is absent in their poems. They pay attention to words and nothing more.
His poems touch the reader's sensations because they are so meaningful and precede even the thoughts forming in their minds.
The third, those whose poems are full of both words and meanings. From among them, we can name Hafez and Sa'di.
Such senses calm mind, imagination, and consequently heart. This is a rare attribute seen in such great poets as Hafez and Rumi. The attribute is common in all Iqbal's poems.
Allama Iqbal has mastery not only over words, but also over various meanings. Meanings which come out of him and are derived from his thoughts. His meaning-oriented poems outnumber his other types of poems, just as Rumi's. Iqbal says, there is no comparison between the melody and me. Speaking is only a pretext. I am pulling the camel, which has no rein.
Allama Iqbal, with a faith in Islam and a reasonable Gnostic faith indicating his deep certitude in God's sovereignty, moves his mind to search for secrets and mysteries of the creation. In his Islamic Gnostic poems, and such verified stories as The Souvenir of Hijaz, The Eastern Message, The Familiar Secrets, and The Mysteries of Rapture, he talks about the principles of internal ontology of things and idealization of the existential world. While his thoughts are at the height of their powers, he invites Muslims to solidify familiar philosophy exactly in accordance to monotheism, to bring about a new perspective, a new worldview into the Islamic world.
So many memories are related to this house. My father came to live in this house when he was 11. Now, what sort of memory do you want me to tell you?
Talking about Iqbal's thoughts reminds us of the familiar thoughts as his central train of thought. We hear Iqbal saying, to a mullah, a denier of God is an unbeliever. To me, more unbeliever is he who denies his own self.
Just ask, what is Iqbal's philosophy? The answer is, the philosophy of your own. Iqbal's philosophy is in fact the philosophy of one's own, or familiar philosophy. What is familiar philosophy? That you know your origin very well.
Never in my life have I been interested in the world's wealth or posts. I built this very house just to accept my wife's repeated requests. My wife's fate in this house had a different form. Here became a safe place for those in search of their identity. I clearly saw that most Muslims in the motherland had lost their Islamic identity, and to regain it, they need to struggle hard. The house, quiet corner, became a place for those who wish to fly thoughts of self-belief, something much needed by all.
The house originally belonged to my father, Javed Iqbal. The house title deed had already been issued to my grandmother. Upon the death of my grandmother, the deed was transferred to my father. Allama Iqbal would live here as my father's tenant. He paid the rent to my father every month or every 3 months.
Never did I lose my interest in my native lands, people. My best time was when I was among people to see them struggle hard to earn their living. I was inspired by their uproar in the Anarkli district. Loftier than the heavens is the station of man, and the beginning of education is respect for man.
Iqbal lays heavy emphasis on the familiar secrets and mysteries of rapture. Familiarity, as seen by Gnostics, means to entertain the self, to fully know the self. It's a famous statement that knowing the self is meant knowing God. Iqbal emphasized, first and foremost, returning to the self. Search within yourself in order to know the self.
Iqbal invites us to know ourselves before doing anything else. Anything else. We shall heighten ourselves to become a human being, par excellence.
From God's own being, the self got a being so. From God's own show, to self he gave a show. About this shining pearl, I know not where. It could be then without a river there.
Iqbal meant to look carefully at human beings on the one hand, and to look carefully at Islamic ideology on the other hand. For that very reason, we see Iqbal describing in detail the Eastern society and the essence of Islamic thought.
Who is a selected man? A selected man is the one who is searched for by God. He is in a form desired by God. God wants that kind of human being. This is possible only if man searches for himself, to train himself in a desirable way, to maintain the self, to try hard to fully understand the self. This way finally leads to knowing well the Supreme Being.
The greatest message of Iqbal, as expressed in his poems, is to know yourself, to turn to your own self, to know the East, not the West.
Signs of going senile can be seen very easily in me. The tick-tock of the clock shows clearly the passage of my life. So quickly pass opportunities. So little time have I to reach the end of the line. Oh, the memory of those days when time's sword was allied with the strength of our hands and unveiled the face of truth. Our nails tore loose the knot of this world. Our bowing in prayer gave blessings to the earth. From the jar of truth we made rosy wine gush forth. We charged against the ancient taverns.
इस घर की तामीर हमारी दादी की ख्वाहिश पे की गई थी पर वो इस घर में
This house was built under my grandmother's wish.
उनकी यहां पे बीमार
But only for 2 or 3 days she lived here.
चौथे दिन वो फौत पा गई.
She was sick when they carried her in a car, but she survived only for 2 or 3 days. At the age of 11, my father lost his mother when my aunt was about 6 years old. My father and my aunt would come here every day to see Allama, who was lying on this bed. Allama called them and my aunt would come up to Allama, and my father would sit on the other side of the bed. This way Allama would feel comfortable.
I usually went to see them after school. Allama was always lying on his bed and resting. I was always beside him. Other people would also go there.
اس گھر میں کئی لوگ علامہ کو ملنے آ چکے ہیں قائد اعظم محمد علی جناح
many came here to see him among them general محمد علی جناح جواہر لال نہرو محمد علی جوہر and many other intimate friends of علامہ
علامہ صاحب اپنے بستر پہ
They would come here just before or after midday to have a chat with Allama about topics like poetry, philosophy, or any other things. Allama spent his last days of life here.
I was well aware that the main reason why India went under the yoke of British colonization was lack of knowledge of self and reliance on others. Self-awareness springs out self-dependence and internal richness. Know yourself, know your hidden parts, nurture your parts, and create a new world, which will compensate for old shortcomings and soul defects to pave the way for comprehensive development. It is the self which originates existence. It is self-awareness which gives birth to human values. It is the self which affects existence. What human beings see or intuit is a manifestation of the self through mysteries. The form of existence is an effect of the self. Whatsoever thou seest is a secret of the self.
Iqbal's philosophy is objective and tangible. He pulls down philosophy from the metaphysical world to make it tangible and applicable to common people. Iqbal's philosophy is therefore a practical philosophy. It can be put into practice.
O Muslims, you have to preserve your own self. You must follow God and His book, the Holy Quran. When you achieve success in making your own self, you can resist even the whole world. No one can harm you. What is the basis of survival? Survival is based on making your own self. It is the self, the nature mentioned by Quran. And this is the essence of Iqbal's thoughts. This is what Iqbal means of the concept of self. For that very reason, every member of the Islamic world should know this way of thinking, personally and socially.
Today we see a group of ignorant people who commit, under the name of Islam, the most heinous acts, though they are all against Islamic teachings. In fact, they are all Satan's companions and toys in the hands of those who want to mislead them. About these people, Iqbal says, Europe very well knows how to secure interests, while granting to this takes a loan of that. It gives sustenance to Satan in a way that leaves perplexed even God.
Nowadays, there are calculated plots against Islam. The enemy is very active to destroy the Islamic world from within. I personally think that we need Iqbal's ideas about Islam now more than ever before. You are simultaneously a learned man, a Sayyid, the descendants of the Prophet. But tell me, are you a Muslim too?
A Muslim is called infidel by another Muslim. It is not a non-Muslim who calls him infidel. It is a Muslim. All problems are created and spread here and there by those who are pursuing only their own interests.
The phrase which brings unity to you all is, there is no God but Allah. As Iqbal says, the key to our unity, salvation, and survival, and a sign of familiarity, is in this phrase, there is no God but Allah. Those who follow this phrase never behead Muslims. Iqbal's basic philosophy is that all of us should be unified. All of us should form one single family. Muslims should get unified to guard the sanctuary. I mean Muslims from the Nile shores to the city of Kashgar.
Iqbal tells us to put aside personal interests and to move into a direction leading to social interests. Put aside your personal interests. Let's talk about our religion, our unity. We will end in success. Just because of his thoughts, Iqbal is living on today. I think so.
Just have a look at the tragic events caused by a group of people who are Muslims in name only, as if there has never been a person like Iqbal. His philosophy has sunk into oblivion, as if Iqbal never lived among us. This is a great sorrow, casting a shadow over all Iqbal's philosophy and thoughts. There is no memory of him anymore. The light of all his great books has gone out. The Everlasting Letter, The Familiar Secrets, The Secrets of Rapture, The Persian Psalms, What Can Be Done, O People of the East, The Rout of Philosophy in Iran, The Eastern Message, and Reconstructing Islamic Religious Thoughts. During his last days, Allama says, "As Iran, full of unknown meaning, I am unable to endure censurers' sayings. Neither have I any option, nor am I coerced. I am but a living soil, always in revolution."
Isi tarah jab aakhri raat thi Allama sahab ki, to wo dono bache isi darwaze pe aaye.
Then came the last night of Allama's life. His two children came to have their last look at him. Allama was still conscious. Someone from Germany had come to see him, a friend of his or his teacher. The German called the two children and hugged them. My father was leaving the room, but my aunt wasn't. She wanted to stay with him for a while.
At the time, I felt I had to stay with Allama and to sit there motionlessly. Our tutor, Aunt Doris, came there to take me with her. I told her, "I will stay here at least for a while."
Allama told the tutor,
"She knows that this is the last meeting between the father and the daughter. That is why she doesn't want to leave. Let her stay.
She knows this is the last time she sees her father."
And finally, I felt something was going to happen. For that very reason, I didn't want to leave the place.
Early in the morning, Allama passed away. The muezzin was calling out the morning adhan. Here, beside this bed, was standing his close friend, Ali Bakhsh. There were some other friends too, although most of them were saying their morning prayers at the mosque at that time. Back then, the mosque was more like a house than anything else. Friends were there to say their prayers in congregation. After their prayers, Allama passed away. His last words were the two testimonies. Then his soul flew to the sky. I personally suppose people like Allama will come to this world several centuries later.
Allama Iqbal Lahori died at the age of 61 on April 21, 1938, after a life of diligence and hard work. In the last moments of his life, he put his hand on his chest, telling Ali Bakhsh, his man, "I have a pain here." And upon uttering this ambiguous, meaningful remark, he bade farewell to the world. Many attended his funeral and accompanied him to his final resting place next to Masjid-e-Shah in Lahore. On his deathbed, Allama composed this song. Does a song gone come back again? No. Does a breeze come from Hijaz? No. There finally came to an end all those days of poverty. Does a Gnostic come back a second time? No. Allama's thoughts and philosophy will remain with us forever, only if we follow him.
Iqbal was a significant voice in the traumatic history of colonized India. His sensitivity to the plight of his people was sharpened both by his understanding of his roots and his adaptability to the demands of the new colonized world. Politics and philosophy were combined in Iqbal's poetry. Perhaps today, Iqbal's anti-colonial stance can be referred to as neo-colonialism is still plaguing the world. And that's it for this week's program. Until next week and another Aperture, it's goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Biden administration has reportedly granted Boeing an export license for the sale of $735 million in advanced weaponry to the Israeli regime. News that came as U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has recently pledged $5.5 million in emergency aid to help Gaza recover from the latest Israeli regime bombing campaign. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Appalling, Biden's State Department quietly grants Boeing an export license for $735 million bomb sale to Israeli regime. Here's more. The Biden administration has reportedly granted Boeing an export license for the sale of $735 million in advanced weaponry to the Israeli regime, news that came as U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken recently pledged $5.5 million in emergency aid to help Gaza recover from the latest Zionist regime bombing campaign. Citing an unnamed congressional staffer, Alex Kane of Jewish Currents, reported recently that the U.S. State Department approved the export license on May 21st a necessary step in the planned delivery of joint direct attack munitions and small diameter bombs to the Zionist regime. As Kane pointed out, the two kinds of laser-guided munitions were reportedly used by the Israeli regime in the 11-day attack on Gaza Strip that ended recently. The Biden administration notified Congress of the proposed $735 million sale in early May, just days before the Israeli regime launched its latest onslaught against Gaza. The nearly two-week aerial and artillery campaign, which Biden administration officials and the president himself publicly defended, killed more than 240 Palestinians, displaced tens of thousands, and further decimated Gaza's critical civilian infrastructure. Warning that selling additional weapons to the Israeli regime would deepen U.S. complicity in war crimes, a small coalition of progressive lawmakers recently mounted a late bid to block the agreement with so-called resolutions of disapproval. But neither the House nor Senate resolution led by Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Bernie Sanders respectively has received a vote as the Biden administration plows ahead with the sale. The lawmakers say Congress still has a chance to stop the deal before the weapons are delivered. Jewish Currents reported recently that after being notified for the export license, Sanders responded by placing a hold on all State Department nominees, blocking Congress from considering them for diplomatic posts. After the administration committed to humanitarian aid for the rebuilding of Gaza, Sanders lifted the hold, according to Jewish Currents. Raed Gerar, advocacy director of human rights group Democracy for the Arab World Now, said in a statement recently that the State Department's secretive approval of the export license is all you need to know about its apparent anxiety at proceeding with this troubling deal while Israeli war crimes and apartheid rule continue unabated. Rather than secretly approving arms sales to Israel ahead of his meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, Gerar added, Secretary Blinken should do his due diligence and travel across Gaza to see exactly what kind of harm and destruction American weapons are causing Palestinians. After his meeting with Netanyahu in Al-Quds recently, Blinken visited the occupied West Bank and vowed that the U.S. will provide $5.5 million in immediate disaster assistance for Gaza and a little over $32 million for the UN Relief and Works Agency's emergency humanitarian appeal. In remarks to the press alongside Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, Blinken said the U.S. is committed to helping realize the aspirations of the Palestinian people, which are like those of people everywhere, to live in freedom, to have their basic rights respected, including the right to choose their own leaders, to live in security, to have equal access to opportunity for themselves, for their children, to be treated with dignity, unquote. But human rights advocates and progressive members of Congress have stressed that selling weapons to the Zionist regime currently occupying and brutalizing the Palestinian people is at odds with any serious effort to secure lasting peace and justice in the region. The State Department should immediately revoke approval for these arms sales to, at minimum, allow for proper debate in Congress, Representative Rashida Tlaib told Jewish Currents. Remember that these are weapons of war and destruction that will be used to kill children, bomb hospitals, homes, and schools. Lives literally hang in balance, she added.
The debate.
And welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. So, trying to control public order or trying to control public dissent. These are the two sides of the UK police crime sentencing and courts bill proposal. Those who support the bill say that this will give police added protection during growingly more aggressive protests. Opponents say it is a new weapon by the Johnson government to stifle dissent and to create a more totalitarian system in England. Well, we're going to take a look at this and see the latest and what it may mean on this debate. I'd like to welcome my guests. I'm going to start it off with Ahmed Caballo out of London. Ahmed, thanks so much for being with us. Ahmed, well, fill us in exactly about the pluses and minuses of this bill. What is being said, why it's needed, and why those who oppose it say it's not good for the country?
Well, I'll start off with those that oppose it. They say that it is a way of silencing dissent, that it comes on the back of large Black Lives Matter protests here in the UK. Most recently, last Saturday, we had one of the largest pro-Palestine demonstrations, 250,000. The week before that, we had 150,000 people just on the streets of London. And they're bringing to question things like Britain's relationship with country, with entities like Israel, with countries like Saudi Arabia, with the racial disparities here in the UK. And the government doesn't want to answer those questions. The government would rather go ahead without any accountability or without any scrutiny. And that's why the Police and Crime and Sentencing Bill is very effective, because it gives the police the power to say where protests can and can't happen, what time they should and shouldn't, they should start and should finish. But more crucial than that, they criminalise people for defacing statues and actually offer harsher sentence for defacing statues than they do for rape. And some are saying at a time where a recent report said 97% of young women have been sexually harassed on the streets of the UK, 80% of all women have been sexually harassed in the streets of the UK, the government are prioritising the wrong thing. They shouldn't be trying to police protest and actually try to police the behaviour of men that sexually harass women in the street, not women that protest against the sexual harassment.
All right, well, thank you for that update. That's Ahmed Caballo out of London. I'd like to welcome my guests also out of London, author and political commentator, Dr. Rodney Shakespeare. Thank you so much for being with us. Rodney, how do you see what is happening? I mean, what would be the main effects of this bill if it passed, in your perspective? Is it simply targeting protesters, or it appears that there are so many other aspects of civil activity that would be targeted with this bill? Can you elaborate?
This pernicious legislation is targeting the protests against major injustices and major issues. It's about targeting the protest against the recent onslaught on Palestinians, on the genocidal onslaught in Yemen, in the creeping genocidal onslaught in Palestine. It's anticipating the public protests over climate. It's anticipating the public protests over what is going to be a collapsed economy, and it's anticipating the protests over the shocking treatment of journalism. And I cite Julian Assange, who languishes in a UK prison because he reported on a war crime, which was the machine gunning of Iraqi citizens from a helicopter.
Okay.
This legislation is the most disgraceful thing that's come into British law for a long, long time. This government is showing that it's now scared of the British public, and it's now trying to behave like an absolutist police state.
Okay, stay with me, Rodney. Let me get the next guest in on this conversation. Out of New York, writer and political analyst Ian Williams. Ian, thanks so much for being with us. Your perspective, why do you think this bill has been proposed at this time?
Well, there are several aspects. One is a lot of it in there, that's in there isn't, in terms of practice, that innovatory. The British police have always exercised far more powers than they're legally entitled to without actually being called for it. You just have to think of the miners' pickets who were stopped on the roads, or even during the Vietnam demonstrations in the 70s, coaches full of demonstrators were turned back with no explicit legal authority. The police have always had a tremendous amount of discretion. The sad thing about this bill is it sort of formalizes this. It basically says, okay, you might have pushed the envelope out before, constables, but now you've got our backing for it. So if anyone is stupid enough to take you to court, we can produce the statute to show that you're entitled to do what you're doing. But the other backdrop to this is, I think that, and it's not just a British thing, it's across the, it's across Europe, is that as, let's say, legitimate constitutional means of effecting change are cut off because the opposition party has been taken hostage by the so-called centre, and the governments are getting more reactionary, there's very few avenues for effecting change or resisting conservative change in constitutional ways. So protests become more and more viable as a means of stopping things. Similarly with the media, as the mainstream media have come more under the control of a few barons, or the, you know, where the BBC acts as the mouthpiece of the government in a way that Pravda would be ashamed of in the old Soviet Union. It gets fairly one of the ways that people can show that things are happening is protests. And
let me just understand what you're saying, Ian. So are you saying that because it's more likely that these protests are going to continue and people are becoming more aware, that the government has to basically use more draconian means to stop them even from protesting?
Well, it's a preemptive move because, they want to punish people for protesting, but these are the means to stop the protests.
Okay.
Look, you just have to look at the scale and depth of the pro-Palestine demonstrations over the last few weeks. That is in no way reflected in the political system. Most Labour MPs are scared of being accused of anti-Semitism. Most of the Conservative MPs are explicitly pro-Israeli. The media doesn't mention them, but mentions Jeremy Corbyn's alleged anti-Semitism. But this shows that hundreds of thousands of people across Britain feel deeply about this subject, and they're bringing it onto the streets as the only means of showing it.
Okay.
So, in effect, if you stop those protests, you're silencing a whole vein of opinion.
Mm.
And sadly, one of the points about this is, you know, if you want to be cynical, letting people protest lets them blow off steam. If you don't, then who knows what people will do? This is the whole point about terrorism is what people do when they're not allowed to do anything else.
What about
general.
That, Rodney? Let me get Rodney back in on this. Rodney, what's your take on that? I mean, what do you think would be the effects if this bill passed? I mean, as Ian says, for example, with the recent pro-Palestinian demonstrations in the UK, that's hundreds of thousands of people taking to the streets. Now, if this is a preemptive measure to stop that form of protest, what would it mean?
Well, it is an attempted preemptive measure because it's quite clear that anger is building. Now, Ian mentioned question of Palestine and the shout of anti-Semitism. The Zionists have played the game of conflating anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. And now that one is now understood, and the anger is building. And as Ian is indicating, on all these issues, people are more aware, and they are going to protest, and the government is anticipating it. But the effect will be to deepen anger and to deepen protest. And this could be the precise moment at which the government's support suddenly starts to drain away.
Okay, well, Ian, now critics say the demonstrations in 2020 and in 2021 have threatened the entire system by even targeting symbols of the whole British system, like statues of Winston Churchill, and demanding a revamping of the whole British system. And this turn in event is very dangerous for the status quo. Your assessment of that?
Well, you just got to look at this ridiculous and frightening scale of it. If a policeman comes up and cracks my skull with a truncheon, he's going to get a medal. If I push a statue over, I get 10 years. I can cause grievous bodily harm to somebody who's not in authority, and I'll probably get far less than 10 years. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is an explicitly ideological move to welcome the sort of the fusties and conservatives of the world. And it's no argument, it's no accident, as they used to say. There was a poll, I think, today that showed that 50% of French police were intending to vote for Le Pen. And I rather suspect that the British police force would reveal similar attitudes, just as many American policemen are members of the various, you know, racist and loony right organizations.
Well, let me just jump in, Ian. You just mentioned, let me just jump in. Sorry to interrupt you, Ian, but you just said something very interesting about the police force in the UK or in France or in the US. What is it about in the police force? I mean, the police are technically coming from the regular part of society. So why are we seeing such an extreme element as far as the way they're thinking and supporting these types of crackdown? I mean, at the end of the day, they are coming from the same societies as the people who are demonstrating.
Look, I've been involved in demonstrations on both nose to nose with the police, and I've found many policemen to be very, you know, actually quite thoughtful and progressive. I remember one policeman in Liverpool, we were wrestling at a picket over Enoch Powell, and he wanted to know why we weren't going after for their pay. I said, you can do it yourself. There was a famous police strike in the 20s in Liverpool. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, you know what happened to us then? And I said, yes, they recruited they sacked everybody and recruited every crook and vagabond in Liverpool to fill the places. And he said, no need to tell me, son. They were my superior officers when I started. So you've still got that level of humanity in the police force. But, you know, there is this idea. It's a self-selecting body. And the police in Britain aren't armed. They don't have impunity. And, you know, they are not going to pull a gun at the first instance. They're very reluctant to pull truncheons. So, you know, it's difficult to make the scale. But on the other hand, they are being given tasks by an authoritarian government, and that includes smashing picket lines, subduing protests, and, you know, there's legitimate things. We don't want mass gatherings with COVID. We don't want lunatics spreading the virus because they're infected with, anti-vaxxer viruses and QAnon lunacy. But there's a question of how you do it and when you do it. Arresting all of those women for protesting about the death at the hands of a policeman of another woman the night before really was a stupid public relations. I mean, it's not just authoritarian. It was like the French general said, it was worse than a crime, it was a mistake. And this is what they've been doing. This government has cloth ears. It does not know about civil liberties. It doesn't know about the lives of ordinary people. But what the worrying part is, like Trump and like Le Pen, it has the ears of people. It knows their prejudices, and it plays on their prejudices. And most people don't go on demonstrations. Most people don't like travelers or gypsies. And most people think that their civil liberties are much more important than anyone else's civil liberties. And they play on these prejudices all the time. Okay. And the left has often failed because they haven't countered those prejudices to get their own together. They haven't pointed out the real issues. They've concentrated on peripheral issues.
Okay.
But the right to demonstrate is a very significant one. And the key point here is pickets, for example, with trade unions. A lot of this law has already been practically implemented against miners' strikes and other strikes. And I have been on these picket lines in the past, and the police have not always been gentle on orders. Most of the time, they're fairly, you know, tolerant and lenient on these things.
Let me get Rodney back in on this. Rodney, do you think that the protesters have become more aggressive? I mean, because what the government is saying, what the police is saying, is that they need to have this bill passed in order to protect themselves.
That's a lot of nonsense. It's not that the protesters have become more aggressive, it's that the issues have become very much more serious. I mentioned some of them before, and I'd like to take this opportunity to mention another one, which is quietly lurking there,
sure,
and could lead to very considerable protests. In America, legislation is asking that there should be reports on unidentified flying objects. Now, they have already admitted that strange things exist, that they don't know what they are. But what the situation really is that the UK government and the American government have been lying to the public for 70 years. And that is another issue which is likely to explode come somewhere in June or July. They may try and evade the issue and not honour the American legislation. But these are big issues, and it is the scale of the issue. I point to the other one, which is the collapse of the global economy. These are big things coming, and they know they're coming, and they're trying to crush protests beforehand. But they need to think that they have a majority of people on their side, because I think that they're not going to have a majority of people on their side, and this could be the turning point for this government.
Well, Ian, I mean, there are expectations that this year in the UK and actually several European countries and possibly the U.S., it will witness growing unrest and protests as people respond to deteriorating social conditions. Do you agree with this possible scenario? And what do you think it means overall? Is there just going to be more of a schism in the society, or your assessment of it all?
Well, I'm not going to go up in orbit with Rodney on the UFOs. However, certainly the global economy is going down into the depths and at some point soon. And the response of all of these governments is going to be increased austerity. They are going to try and make the poor, make the less well-off pay for the disasters they've encouraged and for the COVID that Boris Johnson has so sedulously cultivated as he pranced around pretending to cure it. So there is a lot coming up the track in terms of protestability. People's livelihoods will go. People's jobs will go. People's state support will go. People's houses will be at risk. I mean, you know, I think that it's going to be such a big problem if people can't pay their rent and can't pay their mortgage, as might well happen. This is, before they used to be able to pick people off one by one, I think this is going to happen on such a large scale. We'll get some serious protests. And not just that, but people are getting used to it. They see that if you stay quiet, the government will keep on pushing. If you fight back, you might get some concessions. And it's quite clear, you know, we remember the poll tax demonstrations. It actually turned, you know, this lady's not for turning, but she turned in the face of the poll tax demonstrations, because people in Britain, especially in places like Liverpool and Glasgow, weren't going to tolerate being paid for ordinary people in public housing paying the same taxes as a millionaire in Buckingham Palace. They said it was wrong, and they were right that it was wrong. But they fought back against it.
So Ian, do you think that people are becoming more aware? Do you think that people are becoming more aware of the social problems and feel that they have no choice but to protest? Or why do we see an increase in numbers on the streets for many of these protests?
Well, look, some of this is a question of reporting. I've been on, in my youth, I've been on nuclear disarmament demonstrations, I've been on Vietnam demonstrations, I've been on trade union demonstrations against restrictions, I've been on picket lines, I've been on all of these things, and they were not reported in the past. A lot of them, people weren't aware unless they actually saw them. Now, people are taking pictures, the cell phones are taking pictures, they're being live cast, so people can't ignore the fact they're happening. So some of this isn't that it's new, it's that it's being seen for the first time. We've got past the unofficial and official censorship to show that these things are happening.
Okay. I'm running out of time. Let me get Rodney back in on this. Rodney, where do you see this going? I mean, if it continues the way we're saying and with the possibility of the overall societal situation deteriorating, where do you see this going in the UK?
Well, it's a conflux of very serious issues, and they are coming together, and we are going to have a summer of protests. And this government, of course, it's got cloth ears. They are and their reaction to that demonstration about the death of that young lady, Sarah Everard, where in fact a uniform police officer was and is the suspect. We don't understand the significance in the UK when the suspect is a uniformed police officer and it's about the murder rape of a lady. Then you're blind, not just cloth ears, you're completely blind and you should never be in politics in the first place. So a lot is going on, a lot is building, and the government had its way. They would suppress everything and have no news, no information, but they're making a mistake. I think this is going to be where the boot is on the other foot throughout this summer.
All right, and on that note, I appreciate both of you being with us on this debate. Author and political commentator Rodney Shakespeare out of London and writer and political analyst.